Welcome to Create, Share, Engage. This is the podcast about portfolios for learning and more for educators, learning designers, and managers keen on integrating portfolios with their education and professional development practices. Create, Share, Engage is brought to you by the Mahara team at Catalyst IT. My name is Christina Hoepner. Today, as a holiday gift, I would like to share an episode from the Think UDL podcast that is hosted by Lillian Neef. Dr. Kevin Kelly and I were guests on Lillian's podcast earlier in the year, where we had the chance to talk about the ABLE digital ethics principles in ePortfolios and their connection to UDL guidelines. UDL stands for Universal Design for Learning, that aims to improve learning and teaching for all people. In her interviews, Lillian explores the many different aspects of UDL, introducing her audience to new research, tools, practical implementations of UDL, and insight from practitioners. I don't remember how I actually came across Think UDL anymore, but I'm glad I did. Having been a fan of Lillian's podcast for a while, I was stoked to meet her on screen. It's also always fantastic to collaborate with Kevin, who's been a member of the ABLE Digital Ethics Task Force since it began in 2019. He has been on both podcasts before, and he'll be back here in the new year. So without further ado, here's the episode.
Welcome to Think UDL, the Universal Design for Learning podcast, where we hear from the people who are designing and implementing strategies with learner variability in mind. I'm your host, Lillian Neef, and I'm interested in not just what you're teaching, learning, guiding, and facilitating, but how you design and implement it and why it even matters. Welcome to episode 111 of the Think UDL podcast, Digital Ethics in ePortfolios with Christina Hoepner and Kevin Kelly. Christina Hoepner is the project lead for the open source portfolio platform Mahara, working at Catalyst IT in Te Whanganui Atara, Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. She traded hemispheres and careers in 2010 and enjoys supporting and working with New Zealand and worldwide community of educators, learning designers, and education innovators in both formal and informal learning settings to create positive and supportive learning environments. Since 2019, she's been a member of the Association for Authentic, Experiential, and Evidence-Based Learning, or ABLE, Task Force on Digital Ethics in ePortfolios, and since 2021, a member of the Executive Committee of FLANS, Flexible Learning Association, New Zealand. In September of 2022, Christina started the podcast Create, Share, Engage, in which she interviews members of the portfolio community to share their stories in a contemporary medium, making these stories accessible beyond academic articles and conference presentations. Kevin Kelly works with colleges and universities as a consultant to address distance education, educational technology, and organizational challenges. He also teaches online courses in the Department of Equity, Leadership Studies, and Instructional Technologies at San Francisco State University, where he also previously served as the Online Teaching and Learning Manager. Kevin is a member of the ABLE Board of Directors and the ABLE Task Force on Digital Ethics in ePortfolios. He co-authored with Todd Zakrajek the 2021 Silas book, Advancing Online Teaching, Creating Equity-Based Digital Learning Environments, which is featured in episode 55 of the Think UDL podcast, if you want to go back and listen to that one. In today's podcast, my guests explain the ethics of ePortfolios and how they are aligned with UDL principles. It turns out there is a lot of overlap between the two. Kevin, Christina, and their colleagues on the task force have done all of the heavy lifting so that you don't have to. And you'll find links to the digital ethics for ePortfolios on the Think UDL webpage for this episode. Thank you to our sponsor, TextHelp, a global technology company helping people all over the world to understand and to be understood. It has led the way in creating innovative technology for the workplace and education sectors, including K-12, right through to higher education for the last 3 decades. Well, welcome both Kevin Kelly and Christina Hoepner. I'm very glad to welcome you both to the podcast. Kevin back for a third time and Christina for a bang up first time. I'm really excited to talk to you both about what you've done with ethics and e-portfolios. So let me start off with Christina and ask you the question I ask my guests, which is what makes you a different kind of learner?
Thank you for this question, Lillian. It actually prompted me to reflect a bit more deeply on who I am as a learner than just kind of knowing my preferences that I have. So kind of really being talking with people and not just learning by myself online. And I think at the core, I'm in two camps. So on the one hand, I'm the bee who flies from flower to flower, gathering nectar and helping the next generation of plants to grow and then also supporting its hive. On the other hand, I see myself kind of as an emperor penguin who can dive deep into the ocean to find nourishment, brings the food back to the surface, and then shares it with their family. And while there are, of course, other animals that can dive much, much deeper into the ocean, I kind of like the emperor penguin because they do live in colonies. And so they share, they work together, and they live together. Because for me, it is important that I can share what I have learned, often also teach it to others, which then helps me understand ideas, concepts, and technology better.
Fantastic. That's a very different answer that I've heard a lot of answers, over 100. And that's the first I've had with two different metaphors, the bee and the emperor penguin. So I love it. It's so much in community as well. And Kevin, I've already asked you about what makes you a different kind of learner. So I'm going to actually go on to another question for you and then ask my guests if they want to find out the answer, they're going to have to listen to our previous episodes. But I wanted to ask you about what we're talking about today and what prompted the creation of this digital ethics in e-portfolios principles that we're going to talk about today.
So both Christina and I are active members of the Association for Authentic, Experiential, and Evidence-Based Learning, the longest acronym in the world, ABLE, yep. AAEEBL.org. Mm-hmm. And as part of that community, in 2019, actually, the group leading the conference in July held a forum session designed to interactively engage the conference attendees in identifying issues, questions, reference materials, and resources related to digital ethics and e-portfolios, because it had arisen as kind of a big topic of conversation back then. And so they had discussions ranging from theoretical to pragmatic, and they also wanted to make sure they touched on not just how do we support students, but how do we support educators, staff who support educators, campus leaders, and even folks who work at e-portfolio platform providers, so that we're looking at the whole ecosystem of stakeholders, and you could probably extend that even further to family members and employers and others who review e-portfolios as well as produce or develop them. And so the community at that forum asked for practical guidelines. So as a follow-up, the ABLE leaders launched a task force to begin the work of crafting useful principles that would work for those different stakeholder groups I identified earlier. And similar to the UDL principles, the digital ethics principles wanted to be that highly practical nature. So they give concrete strategies, they have specific scenarios of what they look like for different stakeholders, so they can see themselves in the picture as opposed to trying to extrapolate from some abstract idea that's encapsulated in one pithy sentence.
Yeah, right. So this has been going on for quite a while, since 2019. So here we are recording in 2023. This has been a lot of years and thought going into this.
So we are in the tail end of year four of the ethics task force, the digital ethics task force that was spun up. And each year we get ready to kind of share what we've worked on over the academic year in July at the conference. And then we kick off a new year with how are we going to bring this forward in new ways. In some cases, that has been to develop further principles. In between, in year two, we added principles to the mix. In year three, we looked at ways that we could increase our outreach because people loved them, but not many people knew about them. And this year four, we've been actually even engaging in research around different aspects related to the principles. So it keeps growing, and we constantly touch back to the principles to make sure that they're not only accessible with respect to people using assistive technology, but also people can access them in different ways.
Wow. Fantastic. And every time I get a chance to speak with you, you have so much that goes into everything, every point, every principle, and looking at all of our digital ethics for the e-portfolios, I just see so much research that's gone into it in the last 5 years. So I was really excited to dig into them because there's so much overlap. And let me ask my first question. I'll start with you, Kevin. With the very major overlap with Universal Design for Learning and the digital ethics in e-portfolios, and the first one I'm going to pull up is accessibility. So tell me more about why accessibility is so important as a digital ethics for e-portfolios.
Absolutely. You're right that there is major overlap. And the Venn diagram is like almost a, what do you call it, a lunar eclipse. And so, so many UDL principles suggest providing alternate pathways to present topics, creating multiple pathways for students to engage or communicate, minimizing distractions if they have attention challenges, and all that good stuff. So the digital ethics principles, and the one in related to accessibility in particular, asks different stakeholders to consider similar strategy as they support all students completing projects that could be showcased through an e-portfolio. And so often people think of e-portfolios as kind of a culminating activity, but really it's a growth experience where students are showing their work at different stages to different audiences. So they could show a draft to their peers, a final product to an instructor for a grade, and then a polished product that incorporates instructor feedback to a prospective employer, all using the same tool, but maybe with different reflections. And they all need to consider those, who's consuming this material? Is this an accessible format? And so some of the principals ask faculty and staff to make accessibility a consideration when they adopt the platforms, but then the students need to know about accessibility so that they can be part of the solution. So that when they're creating videos, you know, when I have my own students use Flip as a tool to create small 2 or 3 minute videos, I also, in the instructions for the assignment, share the link to the tutorial where they can go and edit their captions that are automatically generated, because they're good, but they're not perfect. And we want to make sure that they meet the accessibility standards that are set up by our campuses and such. And so really this principle of accessibility in the digital ethics sense is kind of looking at it in a broad sense of what responsibilities we have to make sure that everyone can participate.
Yeah. And one of the things I've been thinking about really recently is, how are our students going to make accessible documents or, you know, hand things into us unless we are teaching them? We need to be doing that. And as you said, make it part of the assignment that, okay, you're handing in your annotated bibliography, make sure it has headings, make sure it is on an accessible document, and that a screen reader could read it. And I haven't seen that as part of assignments very much. And now I'm making that a part of everything that I'm doing, so that means when they upload it or put it into their e-portfolio, you've got fewer steps then too, right? Bake it into the beginning.
Absolutely. And we have, just again, to touch back on how these digital ethics principles are constructed, the principle at the top is supported by a rationale and then a small number of strategies and then these concrete scenarios of what it looks like. And one of the scenarios for accessibility involves modeling how students should create alternative text for images that they use to demonstrate that they've met the learning objectives and things like that. And for something like a student in my class this term created an infographic, which was really complex. So it had a lot of text, and I told them about how to create descriptive long text so that he could not worry about how to encapsulate such a big, weighty image in 10 words or less.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important. And I'm seeing a slow shift, but a shift that's beginning, that now all of our producers, if we're making producers of content, that's what we want our students to be, is creators of content rather than just consumers. We've got to be teaching how to make those pieces of content, I don't know, those examples, to be accessible from the beginning, rather than, oh, now, like you said, the infographic, we've got to redo it, we've got to change it to make it comply with, you know, who your audience is. What happens if you have not just a student, you have another professor, or you have somebody who you're going to be working for one day, or you've got somebody right out in the job world who wants to see what you're doing, and they might need an accessible format in order to understand what you've done.
I think also one point is that I've seen it more recently is that I think we need to get it into our muscle memory. Because, of course, in a way, yes, it might be a bit more work to add an alt text to an image. And when you're rushed, you may not want to do it immediately and think you can go back. But how often do we actually go back? And so if we make it part of the workflow, that when we use an image, there's automatically an alt text added or a caption. And when we create a video or a recording of something, we automatically also make it part of the workflow of the whole task to also create a transcript. And when creating the transcript, then also have it done as live as captions. Because we do have the technology available to help with that so that we don't manually have to put in all the timestamps, yet still correct the automatic captioning. And I think, yeah, that is really important, that we don't see it as this extra bit, but it's just part of what is expected. Like, it's part of creating a table of contents when an essay is turned in, that it does have a reference list and that it does have chapters or different sections. So why not also in regards to accessibility?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I'm glad our listeners are hearing that. And I'm sure many of them have been proponents of this for quite a while. But I think we need to be spreading this word to other fellow instructors, lecturers, as they are now teaching this in their courses. So, Christina, let me follow up and ask about another principle. The first one I want to ask you about is similar, but it's technology and usability, also very much related to universal design for learning. And so can you tell me more about this ethic in the context of the e-portfolios?
Lillian, as you said, it is very similar to accessibility, and therefore a nice lead over into the second principle. Because, of course, when we talk about e-portfolios, technology is often at the forefront of our thinking, because e in this context typically means electronic, though there are also other possibilities of what that E could be. And that's why, yeah, technology and relatedly usability is so important to consider when creating portfolios. Of course, we could just continue with the conversation around accessibility, since that is a huge part of usability, and that I think also shows nicely that the principles that we have developed are interwoven. So they are not trying to stand on their own, but they really also show how they interact, and that we always need to consider the context there as well. But kind of tying our principle of technology and usability a little bit to the UDL principles, I think we can highlight three there. And the first one would be language and symbols. So, for example, can you use the technology that you use to create your portfolio in your native language? We have to acknowledge that not everybody is a native English speaker. I'm neither. I'm just lucky enough that I had learned English in school, and not everybody has that possibility. Is there the possibility of having the interface translated, or at minimum, can you write in the portfolio platform in the symbols that you use? Can you write in Cyrillic? Can you write in Kanji? Or do you have to resort to the English alphabet? Secondly, I think also, and that is also part of accessibility, how do you represent the information? Is it at least encoded twice? So for example, if we have icons in a platform, do you not just put the icon there, but is there also text visible to screen readers that says what this icon is, so that you have the contextual background? Is there maybe also a short description of what this icon means when you hover over it? Because we can't expect that every culture has the same denotation of what an icon could be.
Right.
Looking at the UDL principle of comprehension, then, as a second link to our ethics and or to the link between the ethics principle and the UDL principle, I think there's also, do we provide workflows? And do we have enough descriptions available to the learner so that they don't have the blank page syndrome, that they actually know what they need to do, like having a task description there or know how to go through an application? And kind of also what I've already touched on a little bit, are there commonly known icons used? And is the language in English, it would be plain English, which is not the same connotation that is being used in other languages, but is it a language that is kind of free of lingo so that you don't need to learn an entirely new vocabulary? So that kind of leads nicely, I think, also in the third UDL principle, which is perception. And that means to me, can the terminology used in the technology be customized? Can you cater, for example, to different education levels or to cultural circumstances? Do you actually use the term portfolio, or do you call it something else? And there, of course, I'm a bit biased because I develop an open source portfolio platform called Mahara with a team of developers. And of course, in open source, you have the possibility to make any sorts of changes. So there we can have different language packs. It can be provided in many different languages. And also people using the platform can customize the language. So instead of using blocks, for example, to put on a page, if they realize, well, our learners do not know the concept of a block, they think more in terms of sections, then we can very easily change that to sections, therefore make it easier for them to understand the software and not needing so much front loading to work with the tool. And which kind of also then leads to the final question, if I can't use or understand the technology, how can I actually belong? How can I really feel like I have something to contribute and this technology helps me? Because we are not using technology for the technology's sake. We are using it to complete a task, to learn something, to reflect. And therefore, I think the technology layer needs to be as easy as possible for students as well as faculty to use.
Yeah, you also bring in that last part, makes me think of flexibility, another main UDL principle, that flexibility to use, if it's not a blog, maybe different sections or which tools to use. And I must say, in one of the interactions I've had with faculty in helping actually a math faculty member, they wanted to do a lot of students showing like what their work was. But some of the tools they had could not translate even just mathematical symbols, right? So having a program that that is flexible enough or knows how to recognize superscripts, subscripts, you know, all of the things that might be specific to that particular area, is important and also goes into that design phase, yeah. right? We have to be thinking about this ahead of time, just like our accessibility conversation. It's got to be baked in. It's got to be part of our muscle memory to be thinking about that even beforehand, a big design thought.
Exactly, Lillian. And I think in our principles, Kevin did mention that we have the title of rationale, scenarios, and also strategies. And in the strategies, we want to be very practical, that we imagine what a lecturer could do, what an instructor could do, what is in what situation a student might be, and then translate the strategies that we have developed into a very practical example. Again, also to help that understanding, to make the principles more usable, and therefore give very specific ideas on what it could be. Also showing that it doesn't necessarily have to be something very complicated. A lot of the strategies and scenarios that we showcase are oftentimes very common sense, so that it doesn't have to be that added burden that suddenly people need to learn something completely new.
Yeah, and I really appreciated looking through all of the ethics principles and the scenarios, because it did bring up all the different stakeholders, the ones that Kevin brought up at the very beginning, thinking about students, thinking about lecturers or instructors, thinking about outside, maybe possible employers who might be looking at what learning has happened. And this is just a very different and great, I think, improved type of educational activity than, let's say, the traditional you hand in a paper or an assignment just to your teacher, right? Just to the instructor. And therefore, you know your one audience that you have. And it is a kind of a very closed system. And one of the UDL principles is, so overriding this whole thing is having authentic assessments and authentic tasks. So something that would be useful for a future employer to see how they put together a project or their thinking in going through a process that would be really good for somebody outside of the educational loop to see. And so when you open it up to people outside of just the student and the teacher or instructor, then you open up to, wow, we need to be accessible. We need to be thinking about the tech everybody's using. How are they going to access it on a phone, on a laptop, on a desktop, you know? And it just opens up all these different cans of worms. I don't know, different ways of thinking about it, that we do need the ethics, because if you're just one instructor using an e-portfolio, you might not be thinking about or know to think about all these other kind of variables that now come into play because it's different than just you're going to hand in a multiple choice test or you're going to give me your infographic for just me. And there's just so much more that goes into it. So that's why I think this is just so much labor, so much work that you've made available for all of us that I really, really appreciate.
Thanks, Lillian. And I totally agree with you that the portfolio lends itself very much to authentic assessment and also to being reused, because while we often talk about the portfolio, there's actually multiple portfolios that you create. Like Kevin said earlier, you create one for learning, for assessment, and then you repurpose some of the artifacts for a showcase portfolio. And that also goes to one of the principles we are coming to later, the visibility of labor, that you don't always have to start from scratch.
Yeah, that's great. So, okay, so Kevin, we've been sort of bringing in a couple of words like belonging, we've talked about twice, but there is an ethic called DEIBD in e-portfolios, and I'm familiar in the last year of using not just DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, but also belonging, but there's another D that I haven't seen as often. So I was wondering if you could go through all of these. Can you explain what the DEIBD is and why you've decided that this is important to include, which I agree with, just so you know, in digital ethics in e-portfolios?
Sure. So many educators and the Think UDL community members are probably familiar with diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI initiatives. And I know the UDL team at CAST has recently announced their Equity Rising campaign, where they're actively looking at how to expand the principles in an equity context. You also see publications like Andra Tasha Fitzgerald's book on anti-racism and UDL. And so this is becoming a more concerted effort to look at not just the maybe physical barriers that might get in the student's way of learning, but also institutional barriers, biases, and assumptions that we make. Yale, their Center for Teaching and Learning, has some good ideas about some of those assumptions, like we assume that students who need help know where to get it and also have the wherewithal and agency to ask for it, which we know, especially during the pandemic, we learned that the students who have the most challenge, who are at highest risk of dropping out or stopping out or what have you, are the least likely to self-advocate and ask for help. So
right.
When we look at DEIBD, which we define as diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, as you hinted, spoiler alert, and then decolonization. And so you can see that colleges and universities around the world have expanded DEI to include other core values. Some add accessibility, and they use the acronym IDEA because mm-hmm. of the letters work out. And then others will add social justice, and they'll use the acronym JEDI. And so our task force added belonging and decolonization because we felt that those are global values for e-portfolio practitioners. And Christina just did a great job of describing how the technology itself can affect students' sense of belonging, as well as how the assignments are constructed. Are you doing this in a way that's inclusive, or are you doing it for a dominant culture or for people whose parents who have been to college already? All those different aspects of the experience that we may not think about from our lens, our identity, our privilege. And so we need to step back and make DEIBD part of the e-portfolio process. And so the principle itself sounds pretty straightforward. Educators are aware of equity-related challenges and address learning needs related to each student's identities, cultures, and backgrounds as they create e-portfolios. Sounds easy, right?
Right. There's a lot in there.
Right. So, yeah. But yeah, when you start to unpack it, when you dive into these strategies and scenarios, what we decided to do was look at that principle through different lenses, almost like going to the eye doctor and saying, is it fuzzier
better
now, or is it clearer now? And
right.
So, and we looked at each of those core values, diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, decolonization, to provide a narrower focus so people could tighten in on something that they really wanted to increase, foster support. Mm-hmm. For example, a strategy for fostering belonging includes giving students some choice of expression in their portfolios. This not only aligns with UDL, but signals to the students that their traditional or personal ways of learning, their ways of expressing things, are valued. And so that gives them that sense that, hey, we care not only about your ability to show you reach these learning objectives, but we care that you do it in a way that resonates with how you've gone through the world. Mm-hmm. Focusing on decolonization might include gaining awareness of how different cultures, including but not limited to Indigenous peoples, share and gain knowledge, i.e. the process or knowledge traditions, as well as how they view the world. So what's the context in which they're creating this work that goes in their portfolio? And this also means respecting and adhering to cultural norms and concepts from Indigenous and other cultures that might be very different from the dominant culture. And again, mm-hmm. you know, I work in the United States. I'm conscious of the fact that a lot of things that my students are asked to do come from a very Western, Eurocentric way of looking at the world. But San Francisco State University, where I teach, there are 108 languages other than English spoken at home.
Wow.
And so we have a really diverse set of students, and they're getting more diverse every year as, you know, we're reaching out to increase our enrollments by engaging communities that may have been left out of the conversations in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that means that as we create assignments and ask students to do this work, that we need to be thinking about. It's a very different world with different people. And so on a personal note, I teach a general education class called How to Learn with Your Mobile Device. And this spring, because I've worked on this DEIBD principle with Christina, and we did interviews with educators in the US and Canada and New Zealand, Australia, so it was a variety of people, I made an effort to ask my own students to consider their past learning experiences as well as their knowledge traditions as part of describing their identity as a learner. My first outcome for my class is describe yourself as a learner in the past, present, and future. And to take a little bit on what makes you a different kind of learner question that the Think UDL podcast folks answer, but they're doing it in a very intentional way. And I specifically try to give them hooks to go find more about what they may not have learned about their own knowledge traditions, because if they're not from, you know, an interdependent culture that learns in community, they may be in a very self-paced, do-it-on-your-own, individualistic way of looking at the world. And I want to make sure that people start thinking about the roots of how they come to know and use and apply what they've learned.
Yeah, you know, that makes me think of the fishbowl metaphor, that we're all, as individuals, a fish in a fishbowl, and we don't recognize that the water that we're swimming in is specific to us. And so you had mentioned the interdependent type of community learner versus the individualistic. And I know that my students often will come into my intercultural class learning about that, and they'd say something like, I don't have a culture. I'm just very, you know, very normal, very bland. And there is an assumption that they don't have a culture, but it's really peeling back those layers of an onion. Let's use lots of metaphors here to find out that it's just their way of knowing. One way was that very individualized, I'm going to go in my room, shut my door, read the book, answer the questions. And there are multiple ways to learn that include storytelling and hearing from multiple voices, maybe around a campfire, and hearing it over and over and over again as a way to really imbue it in the way we see the world rather than take a test and move on. And yeah, I have found that I didn't recognize that. I didn't realize that until like way later, like twice as old as my students are now. And having that as part of how students learn and knowing my way may not be the only way is really a threshold concept. Like once you know that, you can't go back into that dark room anymore. Like, oh, people are going to learn differently than I do. And maybe I can learn in that way as well. It might be a little uncomfortable, but I love that everybody should be uncomfortable a little bit, and we don't make the same people uncomfortable all the time, right? So I really appreciated all five letters in the DEIBD part of this principle. And I've followed your work for a while, and I love your mobile learner class because I think all of your students are learning so much more how to increase their ability to be great students, expert learners, which of course is the goal of universal design for learning. So that brings me to another question, another deep dive with Christina here. And that's about data responsibility. You may say data responsibility. I'll take either one. But it's another major overlap with UDL. And can you explain why you've included this in the digital ethics for e-portfolios?
Gosh, I think this is especially now a topic similar to accessibility, where we can just spend 2 hours just talking about that, because it is becoming more and more important. And while it's kind of, I think, always been important, but it has come more to the forefront, like a lot of things have come to the forefront, especially over the last 3 years. So kind of going back a little bit, in the beginning, I said, I'm like a bee who flips from flower to flower. And so I do tend to have the shiny new tool syndrome, like so many in education, that we just want to try the new things because they are cool. We want to see how we can incorporate them. Do they fit how we think of the world, how we want to learn? And so that is really exciting because, of course, a lot of innovation can come from that. And we realize more about ourselves of how we learn. However, I think there is a flip side to it. So I think we do need to be aware, though, of what we share through all of these new tools and where actually our data goes. So a lot of institutions have need to follow certain privacy regulations. So in the United States, it's often the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, commonly referred to as FERPA. In the European Union, it's the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR. And these govern, of course, not just necessarily student data in the case of GDPR, but kind of general personal data, but it does say kind of where you can store that data. And if we ask students to use social media, to use video sharing websites, AI tools, portfolio platforms, both institution provided or ad-based that are often free in the world, are our students actually aware of what happens to their data? Do they still own it? Can others use it? Can they control who can see the content? Because often, of course, we kind of tick the check mark next to the terms and conditions and privacy statements without reading it. And of course, if a teacher tells me I need to use a particular site, then indirectly, I assume that it is teacher institution approved.
Yes.
And therefore, I use it. But has my teacher actually looked at it? Has my educator looked at it? Has it been vetted by a learning designer, not just in terms of the pedagogical implications, but also what actually happens when I actually enter some data? Mm-hmm. And so I think this ties in with the UDL principle of expression and communication, because we do want to have the representation of content in different ways and do want to encourage the use of multimedia. But at the same time, we do need to be aware of the implications for data.
Yeah.
So just to give you a couple of examples for that. Recently, of course, everything is about artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So of course, I'm going to bring that as an example because a lot of people are trialing it and there's so many great possibilities of how we can use artificial intelligence, both as educators and also as students. But did you really read the privacy policy? Did you
Doubtful.
See?
Doubtful, yeah.
Many probably haven't. And so did you know that anything you enter through the web interface into ChatGPT can be used by OpenAI to further train the language model and also to put the content back into their data set to improve their service? And recently there have been news around confidential information being leaked into ChatGPT because employees put in text to make an email sound better that they either need to send to a client or put a coding project in. And suddenly that ends up in a corpus, in a data set where it cannot be removed anymore. And the second example, probably maybe still a little bit closer to the heart of what students do, is if you include a YouTube video in an otherwise untracked web page, suddenly Google is tracking you through the use of that video. Do the students know that? Do the students who put the video into their portfolio know that? Do the viewers interacting with the portfolio know that they are in a way now forced to be tracked? Because they need to watch the video. Mm-hmm. They don't really have a choice because there's maybe not a transcript available, or they just click on it. But do we know all of those things? Mm-hmm. And do we make conscious decisions about which tools we use? And sometimes can we even make decisions? Because, of course, while it's fantastic that we have live captioning in a lot of video conferencing software, if we keep the recording on during, say, a breakout conversation that should be kept confidential, or somebody in the main room, what they don't really want to have recorded normally or want to cut out from the final recording, the live caption still captures it, mm-hmm. and it will go in a data set, and we do not have the control over it. So there are some quite heavy conversations that will need to be had. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of organizations already have them, to make students and faculty more aware of what is actually happening with their data, so that we don't just force students into a situation that they might be uncomfortable in, or ourselves as well.
Yeah, I must say that I came head to head with that technology and data this semester, because I have set up my students to speak with students all over the world. They do a little project where they meet up over Zoom or contact each other somehow. And some countries, WhatsApp is great, and some it's not really appropriate. And so Telegram might be a better option for those students. And some of the students that we worked with could not, Zoom was not allowed in their country. So those were things that I learned and hadn't done all of my background when I added a new partner in a new country that I hadn't worked with before. And I needed to do my due diligence in order to find out, you know, what my students would be comfortable doing, and what the students in some other countries around the world that I was less familiar with. So I learned my lesson, right? And we need to be thinking about it. And thank goodness you've got these digital ethics for us to be thinking about, you know, before we go on something like that. We better be conscious about what we're asking our students to do and know those answers before we, in essence, require them in order to get their grade, right? Before knowing it.
And I think that's then also where again, the principle of flexibility comes in, that once we've made students aware and made it explicit of what potential options there are, to also still give them the option to use those technologies if they're comfortable with them, or maybe even just record things on their computer without mm-hmm. any internet connection whatsoever, and be able to upload it directly into their portfolio platform mm-hmm. rather than needing to use one of those sharing sites that where they might not want to have a confidential conversation appear when the portfolio is being used for mentoring or for healthcare, for example, right. Or when talking with kids, we do need to consider those vulnerable communities as well.
Absolutely. I really appreciate this. We've gone like a big deep dive on at least four of these, but you have all come up with 10. And so I wanted to go over briefly the last six. They're all very important, but in the interest of time, I wanted to ask Kevin if you could briefly go over those three remaining ethics, the practice, evaluation, and promote awareness, to round off our discussion.
I will. And these three, there are three more after those.
So yes, that's
hold
true.
On to your seat. Yeah. but yeah, the principle of practice states e-portfolio creators need opportunities to develop and practice the digital literacies necessary to create accessible and effective e-portfolios. The principle of evaluation says e-portfolio evaluation should consider process, inclusion, reflective practice, and alignment with the stated objectives of the context in which the e-portfolio is created. And the principle of promoting awareness just asks institutional administrators, staff, educators to take responsibility for promoting awareness of digital ethics in e-portfolio making, period. Now, the connective tissue among these three principles can be described as a AAA approach. Awareness, action, and assessment.
Nice.
Everyone involved in the e-portfolio work should be made aware of the types of ethics issues that might arise, should have the tools and skills to engage in accessible and ethical e-portfolio practices, and should be and should take a continuous improvement approach as they look at ePortfolio products and processes. So in practical terms, this would be similar to campus efforts to promote UDL, right?
Yeah.
That means starting more outreach campaigns that link to additional resources, creating training opportunities for students and faculty, and dedicating time and energy, which is a rare commodity. Energy and time are both right up there with palladium, I think, to seeing how well the campus did. And to give a quick example, as a short follow-up to Christina's last comments, this principle could, or this combination of principles could look at universities' data responsibility, right? So more overlap with the Venn diagram. The platform providers ask students to accept an end user license agreement. Click, click. Don't know what I just clicked, but I didn't read it. And that usually describes how they intend to use the students' data, the campus data, et cetera. However, colleges use student ePortfolio data for analytics, for enrollment purposes, for student ePortfolio artifacts as evidence for accreditation reviews. And so then you start asking yourself, are we making students aware that we're using their data in these ways? Are we changing our practices to make the ethics issues known? Are we evaluating whether or not students feel like they're being coerced or doing things because it's helping them get their degree, and do they have alternatives? So you can see that these principles are meant to stand alone, but they definitely work in concert with one another. And that's why we've introduced hashtags or ways for people can find those connecting points from principle to principle.
Fantastic. It's just so thorough, these guidelines. You thought of all of, in the years you've put it together, all of the different stakeholders and ways we should be thinking about it. And I have appreciated learning about it. I've got three more to go, Christina. I'm going to turn it over to you to ask about, if you could explain the last three, the ethics of support and respect author rights and reuse permissions, and then visibility of labor that we hinted at before.
Sure. Let me start with the easier one of the three, and that is the respect for author rights and reuse permissions, because that is fundamental in academia and in many countries around the world. And so I'm sure that a lot of listeners of your podcast are very familiar with those. So that students need to cite their sources, and also that they need to be aware of whether they are allowed to share an image they found online or a video they found online. Does it, for example, have a Creative Commons license attached that allows reuse and maybe even remixing it? Mm-hmm. Or are you allowed to embed the comment, are you allowed to embed the content? Or do you maybe better just link to it? Because then you're not pretending it to be part of what you have done. Mm-hmm. The other two principles are support and visibility of labor. And they, for me, go really to the core of embedding portfolio practice at an organization. Because often we see that portfolios are done by one instructor because they are very enthusiastic about authentic assessment or learning and want to give different ways of learning to their students, make it possible for them to learn flexibly and include the whole human rather than just looking at checkbox activities and essays. And of course, I'm making things very dramatic and painting black and white, which of course is not the case. Mm-hmm. However, really, in order to have these portfolios not just be a one-off activity that students do, but embedded into their general learning, maybe ideally, hopefully, also make them lifelong learners so that they continue with their portfolio beyond the class, is that we do need to provide adequate support for staff and for students, that they need to have the technology available, that they need to have learning designers available who can assist them in revamping activities so that they are suited for portfolio work, that students then also have the support they need through guidelines. Earlier, Kevin mentioned that he points to videos or to tutorials so that students actually know how to use the technology or what they are supposed to do. And all of that culminates in the visibility of labor. That it can't be that, oh yeah, just do the portfolio on the side, it's not much work, but that it's really recognized that there should also be prep time accounted for, that there might even be some relief of other tasks that an instructor does, because also giving feedback on maybe 300 portfolios takes a bit longer than having the learning management system automatically grade a multiple choice quiz.
Yes.
And so we do want to be mindful also about the additional workload often for faculty and staff, but also for students, and also the emotional labor that is being performed, which is not the case when there's a multiple choice quiz, whereas in authentic assessment, where we bring in, where we ask students to reflect on their learning, maybe even bring in some of their personal experiences, it's quite a different sort of task. Mm-hmm. And so really to sum up, we've mentioned a couple of times that the principles are interwoven, that there's a huge Venn diagram that gets bigger and bigger. And really the principles take, I think, a holistic look at the whole area of portfolio practice, because we don't just give techniques and strategies on hand of how to construct a portfolio or how to do better with an assessment portfolio or how to use the technology. But we also look at the wider context. How can, for example, a portfolio implementation at an organization be supported so that then students and staff can focus on more on the details of creating the portfolios, but that the principles really cover the entire portfolio ecosystem. Mm-hmm.
I think it's just so helpful for anyone who is using ePortfolios, which is a high impact practice. It's really something that's I use at my institution. It's so very good for students. It's a reflective practice, which is also another UDL principle for students to look back on their learning. There are so many good things about ePortfolios, but what I see is always an issue is we're asking our faculty to do more and more and more, and oftentimes with less. So here's more time I want you to devote to this. And what you've done with these 10 digital ethics is cut down on the workload for the faculty to have to think about all these 10 different things that, oh, I didn't think about the technology that I was supposed to be using. And now we can design this from the beginning. And you've got a list of ethics, but also the scenarios that tell us, you know, what should you be thinking about so that everybody is not reinventing the wheel every time they want to try an ePortfolio. And so for that, I individually am very thankful and wanted to get this out to more folks so that they can see the great amount of work, the amount of labor that you've put into this, and just the thoughtfulness. The word that keeps coming is thorough. It's so thorough. It's so thoughtful. And then I'm like, that's the same word. Everything is very thorough and thoughtful in putting these together. So I just want to thank you both for the time you spent on this over several years and for the chance to come and talk to me on the podcast. So thank you very much, Kevin, for coming back again.
Absolutely. Wouldn't miss it for the world. And I appreciate the opportunity to connect with you and share ideas with your community.
Always great, Kevin. And Christina, it's been lovely to get to pick your brain and find out all the things that you've put together for this. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Lillian. And I think we do have to also keep in mind that it's not just the work of Kevin and yes. me on the task force. So while we have been two of the founding, kind of in a way, I guess, founding members, because we started in the task force in 2019, there have been lots and lots of people, including Sarah Sohelen from Appalachian University, who are members of the task force. So typically we have between 10 and 13 members each year. And I'm sure, Lillian, you'll link to the webpage yes. on the Able website where we'll have all those names listed. And they come from many different universities from not just the United States, but hopefully also next year we'll be expanding even beyond the borders of the States, Australia, New Zealand, and the Philippines in order to broaden the horizon and bring in even more voices than we have currently on the task force. So everybody who's worked on it, who's come to our workshops, both at conferences and throughout the year, who's helped our thinking and reflect on those principles, going from 10 to 13 and then back to 10, consolidating things, has been really, really important in order to make this huge piece of work and now go more into the research aspect as well. Oh. Yeah, so I'd like to thank everybody who's been involved in the task force in one way or another.
Yes, thank you so much for mentioning that. And it was my colleague, Sarah Zurhelen, who sent me an email. I said, oh, this sounds really great. I wonder who it is. And then it was Kevin. I was like, he's doing this too? This is so much. This is really good. So thank you both and all your collaborators. I will have a link to all the digital ethics on the episode webpage for this podcast. So thank you very much. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lillian.
You can follow the Think UDL podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to find out when new episodes will be released and also see transcripts and additional materials at the thinkudl.org website. Thank you again to our sponsor, TextHelp. TextHelp is focused on helping all people learn, understand, and communicate through the use of digital education and accessibility tools. TextHelp and its people are working towards a world where difference, disability, or language are no longer barriers to learning and succeeding. With over 50 million users worldwide, the TextHelp suite of products include Read and Write, Equatio, and OrbitNote, which work alongside existing platforms such as Microsoft Office and G Suite, enabling them to be integrated quickly into any classroom or workspace with ease. TextHelp has changed the lives of millions worldwide and strives to impact the literacy and understanding of 1 billion people by 2030. Additional support for the podcast is made possible by Appalachian State University, where if you call it Appalachian, I'll throw an apple at ya. The music on the podcast was performed by the Odyssey Quartet, comprised of Rex Shepherd, David Pate, Bill Falwell, and Jose Cochez. And I am your host, Lillian Nave. Thank you for joining us on the Think UDL podcast.
Now over to our listeners. What do you want to try in your own portfolio practice? This was Create, Share, Engage with an episode from Lillian Nave's Think UDL podcast, in which she interviewed Dr. Kevin Kelly and me. Many thanks to Lillian for allowing me to repost the interview. Head to our website, podcast.mahara.org, where you can find resources and the transcript for this episode. This podcast is produced by Catalyst IT, and I'm your host, Christina Hoppner, project lead and product manager of the portfolio platform Mahara. Our next episode will air in 3 weeks this time, on the 10th of January 2024, after the holidays. I wish you, your family, and whānau a wonderful rest of the year and a good start into the new one. I hope you listen again and tell a colleague about our podcast so they can subscribe. Until then, create, share, and engage.